KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
It's time for the Fish Report here on KSDP. We have numbers for the Alaska Peninsula Harvest, the Escapement, as well as an announcement for a new Chignik opener and Bristol Bay. So let's get right to it now with the numbers for the Alaska Peninsula Harvest for the 27th of June, 2025. Starting with the overall harvest for the AK pen. For sockeye, 51,000 were harvested yesterday for a total now of 725,000. No significant numbers of Chinook or Coho. There were 3,800 pink salmon and 2,900 chum. We're at 115,000 pinks and 151,000 chum salmon to date. Over in the Dolgois, there was 1,000 sockeye delivered for a total now of 1,800. For the Shumagin Islands, a total of 3,000 pinks were harvested. They're at 45,000 to date. And no significant number of chum. South Unimak also didn't have any significant numbers there either for sockeye, pinks, or chum. But Nelson Lagoon had 8,000 sockeye delivered for a total now of 73,000. And Port Miller to Outer Port Hyden had 34,000 sockeye delivered yesterday. They're at 228,000. Looking now at Bristol Bay, above 1 million again yesterday. 1.2 million sockeye delivered. They're now at 5.7 million to date. Looking at the different districts, the Ugashik had no new sockeye. But Egagik had 336,000. They're at 1.07 million. Naknek had a day of fishing yesterday for a total of 178,000 sockeye. They're at 500,000 to date. The Nushagik had 697,000 sockeye for a total of 3.6 million. And Togiak with 1,700 sockeye for a total of 14,000 to date. Chignik, the day before yesterday, they announced a harvest. For Chignik, they had 31,000 sockeye harvested on June the 26th. They're at 90,000 to date. And today at 5 a.m., they opened for a 67-hour opener, so more opportunity for fishing in Chignik. Escapement for Chignik, 32,000 sockeye escaped yesterday. They're now at 223,000. And again, above every year in the past 10, 2023 had 210,000 by now, but not as much harvested. The Nelson River, total of 23,000 sockeye to date for a total of 156,000. This time last year, they're at 70,000, so twice as much as last year, but every other year, still way ahead. Bear River with 2,100 for a total of 27,000 to date. Ilnik had 139 for a total of 17,000. And then Orzinski, 800 fish yesterday in Orzinski for a total of 1,500 to date, trailing only 2016, which is at 1,600 by now. There was nothing new from Kodiak yesterday, so that does it for the Fish Report here on KSDP. This report was brought to you by Heliostar Mining. Stay tuned for more great programming coming up right now.
KSDP is generously supported by Precision Airways in Sandpoint, Alaska, offering chartered air services throughout the Aleutians Eastborough and beyond. For more information on charters and prices, Theo is available at 907-989-4080. Precision Airways is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
You've been doing that 9-to-5 straight line, walking, yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Since I've seen that letting down your hair, double dog dare. In your eyes.
Oh, when you've been burning it at both ends. Been a hot minute since you flipped that switch.
Girl, it ain't nobody's fault. Shut the world off and turn it back to win. It was you, me, and whiskey all night long. Sinking to the bottom of them country songs. Fire burning hot till the last drop's gone. Let's turn it up. Nothing else.
sweet, ain't nothing as strong as you. Songs, turning this house to a honky tonk. Let's turn it up, till we take that black label bus too far. Say them things to stay in the dark. Ain't nothing as sweet, ain't nothing as strong as you and me and whiskey all night long.
Ain't Texas, ooh. Ain't no hold 'em.
Hey.
So lay your cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus,
ooh.
And throw your keys up.
Hey.
Stick around, round, 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 round.
Stick around.
And I'll be damned if I can't slow dance with you. Come throw some sugar on me, honey, too. It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down. Don't be a b- come take it to the floor now.
Woo!
There's a tornado,
tornado
in my city.
In
the basement. That ain't pretty.
Rugged whiskey.
We're surviving.
A
break of kisses. Sweet redemption. Passing time, yeah. Ooh, one step to the right. We headed to the dive bar. We always thought was nice.
Texas, ain't no hold'em.
Hey.
Lay your cards down, 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 down. So pop your Lexus, throw your keys out. Take it to the floor.
I'll be damned if I cannot dance with you.
Come pour some liquor on me, honey, too.
It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down.
Don't be a b- come take it to the floor now.
Feel dramatic,
feel dramatic.
Now to the front.
I'll be damned if I cannot dance with you. Come pour some liquor on me, honey, too. It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down. Don't be a come take it to the floor now. Ooh. Take it to the floor now. Ooh.
Oops. Spurs.
Boots. To the floor now. Ooh.
Tell me.
Take it to the floor now, ooh.
And I'll be damned if I cannot dance with you. Baby, pour that sugar and liquor on me too.
Spurs, spurs, boots.
Sologenic, photogenic, shoot.
This year is just me moving slow. You were coming out to Pineville, it was freezing cold. I'm getting old by the day. You said and gave your heart something to believe in, 'cause boys like us fade away. But you stuck around when I was down.
lucky, saying we were lucky for the light. Who'd have thought those things would find a billboard way out in New York at night?
Thinking of the times that you didn't bat an eye, all those times of shame, them boys of faith, them boys of faith. High tide, it's been rising up, I've been getting up with some boys I used to know. We're trying. This year is just me moving from the soul.
This is Dmitry Filimonov, President and CEO of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.
The Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association is hosting a virtual dementia tour on June 10th at the Sandpoint Public Library. The virtual dementia tour is an interactive personal experience providing insight on what day-to-day life is like for a person living with Alzheimer's and related dementia. This free event is from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. and 25-minute slots are available and open to everyone. Space is limited, and for more information, contact Lorraine Thomas at lorrainet@apiai.org, or you could find a flyer in your community with the link to sign up.
Remember, if you are in Anchorage, please come visit the Unangamula, home of the Aleuts. Unangam Atakan Akun. We are one.
Visit us online at www.apradio.org.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sand Point, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sand Point Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Schumigan Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sand Point, on the web at www.schumigan.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Schumigan Corporation. Hometown Values and Service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sand Point, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
It's time for the Fish Report here on KSDP. We have numbers for the Alaska Peninsula Harvest, the Escapement, as well as an announcement for a new Chignik opener and Bristol Bay. So let's get right to it now with the numbers for the Alaska Peninsula Harvest for the 27th of June, 2025. Starting with the overall harvest for the AK pen. For sockeye, 51,000 were harvested yesterday for a total now of 725,000. No significant numbers of Chinook or Coho. There were 3,800 pink salmon and 2,900 chum. We're at 115,000 pinks and 151,000 chum salmon to date. Over in the Dolgois, there was 1,000 sockeye delivered for a total now of 1,800. For the Schumigan Islands, a total of 3,000 pinks were harvested. They're at 45,000 to date, and no significant number of chum. South Unimak also didn't have any significant numbers there either for sockeye, pinks, or chum, but Nelson Lagoon had 8,000 sockeye delivered for a total now of 73,000, and Port Mooar to Outer Port Hyden had 34,000 sockeye delivered yesterday. They're at 228,000. Looking now at Bristol Bay, above 1 million again yesterday, 1.2 million sockeye delivered They're now at 5.7 million to date. Looking at the different districts, the Ugashik had no new sockeye, but Egigik had 336,000. They're at 1.07 million. Naknek had a day of fishing yesterday for a total of 178,000 sockeye. They're at 500,000 to date. The Nushagik had 697,000 sockeye for a total of 3.6 million. And Togiak with 1,700 sockeye for a total of 14,000 to date. Chignik, the day before yesterday, they announced a harvest for Chignik. They had 31,000 sockeye harvested on June the 26th. They're at 90,000 to date. And today at 5 a.m., they opened for a 67-hour opener, so more opportunity for fishing in Chignik. Escapement for Chignik, 32,000 sockeye escaped yesterday. They're now at 223,000. And again, above every year in the past 10, 2023 had 210,000 by now, but not as much harvested. The Nelson River, total of 23,000 sockeye to date for a total of 156,000. This time last year, they're at 70,000, so twice as much as last year, but every other year, still way ahead. Bear River with 2,100 for a total of 27,000 to date. Ilnik had 139 for a total of 17,000. And then Orzinski, 800 fish yesterday in Orzinski for a total of 1,500 to date, trailing only 2016, which is at 1,600 by now. There was nothing new from Kodiak yesterday, so that does it for the fish report here on KSDP. This report was brought to you by Heliostar Mining. Stay tuned for more great programming coming up right now.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
nerd. Hey, Ray!
Why, hello, David!
How you doing?
I'm good, I'm good. A couple of sunny days here in the old Tongass National Forest, and it's beautiful. I've been out working in the yard, you know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I was saying I miss Alaska. I miss the rainy days, I miss the misty mountains, I miss the wildlife and the beautiful sunsets that last for 6 hours in the autumn.
Yes, it's beautiful light now, and my wife and I, Michelle and I, went walking deep into the woods yesterday, and you know, it's just wonderful. Oh, yeah, I love my strolls through the ancient forest here.
And were you visited by the raven spirit?
I was. In fact, I recorded some, Dave. So maybe
did you really
record it? So maybe at the end of the show.
Well, let's listen to a raven in the forest right now. I love how it echoes.
The two of them.
So
there's
cool.
Two of them.
Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, we were deep in the forest and, you know, the yard work and the ships are here, you know.
Oh, the great cruise ship, the great tourist migration.
Yes, the invasion is on. It is on. But yeah, so yeah, it's always good to be here with you, Dave.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be fun. We have a great episode today and I'm doing some traveling. I'm going to New York to watch my son graduate from 4 years of university.
All right, well, congratulations.
He's going to get a BA in modern music, but the good news is that he just got accepted to the Berklee School of Music Master's Program.
All right.
So, continuing education, higher education for my son. Very proud of him.
Excellent, excellent. I'll be joining my son in Juneau in about 2 weeks for a rock and
roll
event.
You're doing a concert there. Yeah, this is recording now in May of
2025.
When is it?
2025.
Yeah, and it'll probably air in June, maybe.
Yeah. So anyways, we're going to be playing rock and roll with my son. He's in my band. His band's going to play in my niece's band. It's going to be
That's so cool.
Calling it Troll Fest. We'll see how it all goes.
And, you know, your band and his band is where I pull most of the music to populate this podcast with fantastic interstitial mood music and tunes. And
yeah.
And I thank you for your creative contributions.
Yes, and your son is a musician now too, so that's cool. So yeah, goes around, comes
yeah
out.
I told him a musician, it's a great career, but it's only a hobby unless you're making money.
Yeah, good luck with that. So
tell me how you met our guest, because this is another great rabbit hole I went down, and it's, oh my god, it's early fishes, and it's
Acanthodians.
Acanthodians.
Yeah, so there are a lot of Latin will be tossing around today.
Yeah, yeah. Helotus? Is it Helotus?
Helotus. You had me at Helotus, yes. We're going to talk about Helotus, which is a weird chimera from way back when.
A chimera is a ratfish.
Yes, there's many names for ratfish, spookfish, ghost sharks is what they're called. But basically, they're really ancient fish, you know, chondrichthyans. Yeah. They have cartilage skeletons. Yeah. So, yeah.
Chondrichthyans are sharks, rays, skates, and sawfish.
And the chimeras, of course. Yeah, chondrichthyans.
Elamobranchs are sharks, rays, skates, and sawfish, right?
Elasmobranchs, sir. Elasmobranchs. Yes. Brank.
Oh, my God.
Elasmobranch. There's a lot of buzzing going to be going on. But anyways.
Well, you know what? I didn't put an S in there. Elasmo. Going to put a
Everybody
S
repeat
in there.
With
Elasmobranchs
me.
Are a subclass of Chondrichthyans.
Oh, man. Okay, Chondrichthyans.
Yeah, but, you know, that's why I have you to constantly correct me.
Well, you're the showbiz guy. I'm the Latin guy, whatever. But yeah. I met Mike.
This is Michael Coates.
Mike Coates. He goes by Mike, but Michael Coates in Chicago. I met him maybe about a decade ago. But I first knew about Mike when I just started diving into Paleozoic, prehistoric sharks, really, really old sharks. And I began to find out.
Because that's your
that's
thing.
That's my thing.
Prehistoric
yeah.
sharks, prehistoric
yeah.
fish.
And people tolerate me when I start talking about all this. But hopefully
well, I always
you do.
Say you're Ray Finned.
Yes. But that's a different fish. But anyways, I started reading about Mike's work, and I saw that he'd actually worked on one of my favorite Paleozoic sharks, this weird, you know, anvil-headed shark is what we call it now. And you know about that shark as well.
You mean the Stethocanthus?
Yes. He named one that's in that group. It's called Acmonostion zangrilli, and named after my friend Reiner. Anyways, Mike's also an artist. I began to see his work in some of the books that John Long has done. So I've actually seen his drawings of the Stethocanthus sharks. And
John Long, the fantastic author of
many books. The Rise of Fishes
books,
and
Rise of
the
Fishes.
Latest ones
he
sharks.
Showed me the first fishes, the first evidence of sexual intercourse in vertebrates.
And that's what Mike does. He studies really the origin of vertebrates. Where did we come from?
Right.
You know, so along the way, there's all this stuff at the beginning there.
And we're going to have some news about lampreys, too, which is going to be so cool. So,
but anyways, Mike is in the family of paleo nerds, I believe.
Well, I'm going to ask him that question. So what do you say we call him up in Chicago?
Let's do it, man.
Here we go.
Dial him up. Hey, Dave, meet Mike Coates. He's a vertebrate paleontologist and chair of organismal biology and anatomy at the University of Chicago. Professor by day and fish by night. He also builds dodgy robo sharks on the weekends. So, yeah, great to have you here. And, this is Dave Strassman, Mike.
Oh, pleasure to meet you, Dave. And
pleasure to meet you, Mike. I know I've traveled all through Old Blighty, which I'm assuming that's where you're from.
It is indeed, yes.
Ah, fantastic. And the question is, obviously, we ask all our guests, are you a paleo nerd?
Yes, I suppose I am, yeah, yes.
Oh, there's no conviction?
Something I've become.
Well, let me ask
you. Oh, you've become
Yeah, let me ask you that. What is your origin story, and how did you come to paleontology?
My origin story is I grew up on the coast, the Suffolk coast, the easternmost bit of the United Kingdom. And I enjoyed picking up dead things on the beach. So I suppose my origin story, my mum was still around, would repeat, was finding some dreadful smell coming from my bedroom and discovering, and I remember this, I found a dead seal pup, you know, sun-dried on the beach. And the skeleton and the flippers and everything, it was superb.
Cool.
That was what, you know, I'd found and taken home.
I was going to say seagulls and ambergris.
Well, yeah, it'd be hard pushed to find some ambergris in the North Sea. But amber, yes.
Really?
Yep, and there were shark teeth, etc.
Is it Jurassic amber?
No, it's Eocene amber, and it comes from the Baltic.
Right.
But it's all shingle beaches around there, a lot of erosion. And just north of where I grew up, etc., you've got a lot of Eocene crag coming out of the cliffs that crumble around, and an awful lot of erosion there. So I would go and pick up odd fossils on the beach, but I wasn't really any kind of a rock hound or fossiling in earnest. It was just general interest in natural history. And in hindsight, fascination with morphology, vertebrate anatomy.
Okay. So
that was the bit.
That that dead seal, you took it into your room to study it and...
Yeah, draw it, understand it. I must have been about eight, nine years old.
Really? Wow.
You know, at the end of school, I went to do zoology, not geology. I studied zoology at university. And through there, that's where I got into vertebrate paleontology seriously, because I was interested in evolution, and it's the sort of perfect synthesis of evolution and really morphology. I love morphology. For me, it was very split. At the time of leaving school, whether I was going to go to art college or go to university and study science, it's that difficult split.
Right. Well, I know you actually do artwork yourself, and we talked of art, and we drew sharks together when I saw you in Chicago. So that was that a serious, interest of yours too, art making?
Yeah, very serious. So before I went to university, while I was at high school in the UK, while I was doing my A levels, you specialize early in education in the UK. So I was doing three science A levels and fine art.
And so
I was going to the local art college to do life drawing and all that sort of basic grounding in materials, etc. So I was doing my sort of intro year at art college. It's, as you would know, if you're a scribbler, that's how you understand the world.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, did the art classes help you visualize the...
All the time.
...biology you were studying?
Yeah, not only the evolutionary biology, but cell biology, developmental biology, etc. I mean, I'd get gigs all the time doing bits on the side. When I was an undergrad, I did a lot of posters for bands.
I made
a bit of money on the side. Yeah,
really?
On the
Pink
side.
Floyd, Led Zeppelin, The Who?
I'm a bit younger than that, but it was more outfits like The Cure and so forth.
All right, man.
Oh, wow.
So,
diving
out.
This is just gigs at the university.
Wow.
So
I really do feel that to draw something is to know something. It's to, you draw it, you take the time to study it, and you know it then, you know? So it's really a direct way to, you know, gain knowledge about the world. So it's kind of cool to hear you say that. And, of course, the rock and roll thing is also near and dear to my heart. So
yeah, you're both into the rock and roll.
Oh, yeah, man. But, but now you have a lab at the University of Chicago.
Yeah, I saw that, the Coates Lab, with a whole bunch of researchers as part of this institution. Does everybody, are they all off on their individual studies, or do you have a goal to find the answer for the first lamprey? I mean, which I want to get into, because I am shocked that lampreys are not what they are.
Let's do that a little bit later.
Yeah.
What does the Coates Lab do, and how did you set that up?
The Coates Lab, overarching thing for it, is to understand the roots of the modern vertebrate biota. And it's very much integrating paleo with modern biology. So it's not exclusively fossils.
Right.
I work closely with developmental biologists, and did so well before I came here. But the general theme behind all of it is trying to understand how the root of the principal divisions of modern vertebrate life. So you've got the bony fishes, you've got the cartilaginous fishes, those two groups within the jawed vertebrates, and then you have the jawless forms, the cyclostomes, hagfish and lampreys. Those groups originate deep in the Paleozoic.
Hmm.
And how is that? What do we understand about the earliest members of those groups? How do the extinct groups of early fishes relate to them? There's a two-way...
You mean to the extant?
Yeah, to the living groups.
Organisms.
Yes. So there's been massive changes over the past 10, 15 years about how we understand the links between the extinct groups and the living groups. The groups of so-called spiny sharks, acanthodians, were linked to the bony fishes. Now, things have come full circle in a way from... They're originally called spiny sharks, and now we recognize that they're the root of sharks. They are the extinct members of the shark branch of vertebrate biodiversity. They're the extinct members of the family tree that branched off before the last common ancestor of ray troll and a ratfish.
that it all gets a little difficult to follow, even for me, who's kind of well-versed in these things. But why don't we plunge right into it? I guess I was reading on the website one of the goals of the lab, or just in some of the work that you do, you've been upending the long-held belief that sharks truly ancient line of marine predators. So what does that mean?
There's a long history of talking about sharks as if they're living ancestors.
Right.
They're somehow more primitive than bony fishes. And then if we look at their skeletons, it's made of cartilage. There's no bone in there. And if you look at the outside of them, they're covered in tiny scales. They don't have big, chunky plates and proper skulls like we do. And the recognition now is that having a skeleton made solely of actually very specialized cartilage is a very specialized feature. It's highly derived. Having a bony internal skeleton for jawed vertebrates is primitive. Likewise, having the outside of your body covered in big armored plates is primitive. So, in a sense, our face, our skull, if we were talking to Professor Shark next to us, he'd kind of look at us and give us a sort of, you know, fairly poo-pooed, you know. It's sort of fairly unsophisticated.
We're primitive.
Yeah, we're primitive. We've still got a face encased in this sort of great bony superstructure that they've dispensed with.
But when you say primitive, is that time delineated? Or
no,
is it evolutionarily delineated?
It's evolutionarily delineated. I'm talking about, you know, if we think about traits such as bone and the components of our face, such as our cheekbones, the jugal, or the bone that builds our upper jaw, the maxilla with the teeth in it, or the bone in our lower jaw with the teeth in it, the dentary, etc. You find those across all bony fishes, and if we go back in time, you'll find the equivalents of those bones in some of the extinct armored fishes.
Right.
Which precede the split in the evolutionary tree, where bony fishes went one way and sharks went the other. And sharks ditched that external bony skeleton.
In the simplest terms, do sharks come before the bony fish?
No.
So
they developed alongside.
Yeah, we have a last common ancestor,
right,
which now must be excess of something like 430 million years ago, 435 million years ago. We're pushing that last common ancestor down into the Ordovician.
Wow.
Which is incredible, because if someone was to refer to a time, you know, a geological slice of time, so it's a lovely cartoon that I've seen used many times of Ray Trolls.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of. You know, the fossil record, yep. Getting right down to the bottom.
Devonian is the age of fishes.
Yeah, you have to go well before that. You've got to go all the way through the incredible shrinking Silurian and then down into the Ordovician. And then you look at the fossil record of fishes from the Ordovician, and you've got only three kinds of articulated body fossil of fish from there. And they each look like an armor-plated tadpole.
Right.
No paired fins. It's a sort of carapace at the front end and a scaly tail out the back. And a mouth that looks a bit like a small hole or a letterbox. And all the sense organs crammed at the front. There's nothing in front of the eyes. And yet we know that contemporary with those, there must have been the earliest kinds of sharks, the earliest kinds of bony fishes, and the earliest jawed fishes, which preceded that last common ancestor between you, me, and a ratfish. They must be knocking around there somewhere, but we haven't found them yet.
I see. So you don't really have that last common ancestor in the fish.
And is that based on
all the fish
taxonomy? Is it based on what? How do you know it's missing? I mean, obviously, it's not there. But I mean, we know there are millions of T-Rexes yet to be found.
Yeah. How is this a known unknown?
Because Mr. Rumsfeld.
My fave. You have to trek through the Silurian, and it's what we find in the Silurian. What's coming out of China more recently are the earliest members of the shark lineage and the earliest members of the bony fish lineage. And then if you go to localities in the States and elsewhere, there's a place called the Harding Sandstone, and there's places in Australia and in the Middle East where you can find isolated scales, and in Siberia too. And what you find is scales that are really diagnostic that they fell off the body of one of these kinds of fishes.
So you've got these tantalizing clues.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, evidence, yeah. Actually.
Huh. Yeah. And in fact, one of those tantalizing clues we call Tantalippus.
Tantalippus alone, well, yes.
Just for our listeners, give us a primer starting in the Ordovician of the jawless fishes, and then they became kind of armor-plated head. When I'm talking about the, you know, Dunkleosteus, I'm talking about the first, they had these carapaces that were almost dentition, right?
Ostracoderms.
Take us from there to the little wormy guys to the split off between the sharks and the bony fishes.
Well, that's a small challenge. Right. Okay, here we go.
Just briefly for someone who has no idea what we're talking about.
These things are described as looking like armor-plated tadpoles. No paired fins, obviously no paired limbs, you know, perhaps suggestive, not even decent evidence of little keels sticking out of the side. So these are things called astraspids.
Okay.
And they all end in aspis. So you've got Arendaspis, Astraspis, and Sacabambaspis, the one from South America.
Yeah.
And I like Sacabambaspis. It feels like it ought to be a percussion instrument.
It does.
It sort of looks, yes, a bit like it.
Yeah. It's a song, if nothing else, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It ought to be, on, you know, putting down some good rhythm in the background.
Bum, bum, bum.
So that's the kind of stuff that's popping up in the Ordovician, along with a lot of very similar scales that belong to these kinds of fishes. When you move through the Silurian, you find more of these, as you call them, ostracoderms, and you start getting things like heterostracans. So these also consist mostly of an armored carapace at the front, but some of them have a long pointy rostrum, a long pointy snout, and keels, prongs, sticking out at the side. Some of them get very broad and almost look like those sort of robo vacuum cleaners, you know, the little robotic ones that buzz around.
The Roombas.
That's it, a Roomba. If I had a Roomba, I'd want to stick a tail on it, and they look like some of these.
Oh, right, right. A big disc for a body and a tiny tail.
Yeah, covered in large plates.
Mm.
Very distinctive kind of bone that they have. But these things are probably, you know, feeding. They're bottom feeders. They're in the benthos, using a
techie term. And how big
term.
In centimeters?
Well, some of them are getting about 50 centimeters across, or some of them get quite big.
A couple feet.
Many of them are small, thumb-sized, but, you know, they're quite diverse.
Because when John Long showed me his metapices, yes, that thing was the size of my fingernail. I was expecting a large creature.
The larger ones are Devonian. What this actually, there's another aspect to this which I kind of like, because, you know, when I first heard about this as undergrad and, you know, I was looking at books of prehistoric monsters and fish as a kid, you got the idea that you had the jawless fishes, and then there's the invention of jaws, you know, like that Sistine Chapel creation moment. God goes, zap, let there be jaws. And there ought to be some sort of massive layer of devastation and blood in the fossil record where the jawed things came in and destroyed the jawless forms, and they were cast out of a little ichthyological.
It's getting biblical here, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just what doesn't happen, because as we push these dates back, these things are coexisting for tens of millions of years.
So they must be occupying different niches.
Yes, and that's partly trying to work out what the earliest jawed things are doing and what these jawless forms are doing, because there's a much greater variety of them then than there are today. So how are they dividing up the ecology of the time? What are they doing? Are they making short excursions up into the water column? You know, they've got sophisticated tails. They're not, you know, they're not. Tadpole is oversimplifying them. They've clearly got a lot of sophisticated senses on them too. We get clues from their skeleton about their sense organs, and that's something that interests my lab a lot at the moment.
This is 420 million years ago we're talking.
Exactly. So, wow. Yeah. 420, end of the Devonian, the end of the Golden Age of fishes, 360. So that gives you 60 million years of, if you like, coexistence of lots of jawless forms, the earliest jawed forms, and then the advent of the modern jawed forms, all getting squished into that 60 million years. And that's, after all, the time episode since the last dinosaurs to the present. There's a lot to be understood down there.
Well, if I could bring it around to ratfish for a moment.
Ray's favorite.
My favorite topic, you know.
Chimeras.
So I have been fascinated with ratfishes, also known as chimeras. And these days people are calling them ghost sharks, which sounds pretty cool. So ghost sharks, I caught a ratfish up here, blew my mind. They just look so weird. They've now, with the recent paper that you are working on with Gareth, they've gotten even weirder. There's this new work on the tenacula.
Oh, the tenacula.
This is a 3D print that I'm holding.
Let me take a photo of that, Ray, so that we have that in our...
I'm holding up what is the finger-like shark tooth-covered tenaculum. Comes out of the forehead of a ratfish. Ratfish are, and this weird little appendage. Can you just explain to Dave and I and the world?
Well, when did they first appear in the evolutionary?
Well, yeah, but let's get into the tenaculum. But take it away, Dr. Coates.
Well, the tenaculum is the grasping device that comes off the forehead of all male modern ratfish.
Okay.
Now, the history of that organ and its function is only just beginning to sort of make some kind of sense. So the fossil record of ratfish runs back at least to the Carboniferous, and it must go earlier into the Devonian.
Mm-hmm.
But the best body fossils that we have go back about 320 million years. And some of the most spectacular ones, yep, come from localities such as Bear Gulch,
yep,
in Montana.
In Montana.
Yep. What you find there is great because it's body shapes, but the skeletons are so compressed and demineralized, it's like looking at a lithograph in a book or something like that. It's,
squish
getting
flat,
the 3D-ness out of them is difficult. But we've been lucky to, with CT scanning, which the lab has used a lot over the past 10 years, more in fact, well over, and we CT'd some slightly younger material of a fish called Hylodus. Now, Hylodus has been known by its teeth for years and years. So ratfish have crushing tooth plates. They're very specialized dentition. Some people would say they don't have teeth at all.
But you mean like a ray?
Like a rabbit.
A ray has...
Yeah, well, yeah, just...
Yeah, but even more than a ray. A ray, if you look at a ray's tooth plates, you can see that they're like what dentists get upset about, impaction. They right. have lots of teeth they're pushing out together, and they all get crammed up like piano keys. And some of them push out the front like a piano keyboard, and they can use that as a crushing surface. But in fact, if you look at a ratfish's tooth plates, they have a pair at the front, which Ray's absolutely right. They're like the incisors of a rabbit coming down.
Huh.
But then they have another.
I mean from the upper jaw.
From the upper jaw.
From the front
yep.
of the rostrum of the upper jaw.
Correct. And behind that, they've got a large triangular pair, and the lower jaw just has one large triangular pair. And those bite down on each other, and they have sort of sharp ridges. And a more sort of beveled cushion edge to it. And they have sort of ridges in those of super hard dentine, the same stuff we find inside our teeth. But they don't have enamel. What they have is a mixture of softer and harder dentine. And they have an open pulp cavity at the back. So it's almost like, imagine you've got one massive molar growing forwards across
right.
the jaw. And
right.
it's continually growing through life. That's what they're using to feed with. Those preserve well in the fossil record. The earlier forms in the fossil record have a very similar material that makes up the tooth plates, but as single teeth or separate teeth, arranged in tooth families like you find in, if you like, conventional sharks. So they huh. switched from separate teeth to having the tooth plates. Now, those isolated teeth, again, have a much richer record in the strata, the fossil record, than bodies. So, back to Hylodus.
Well, they're cartilaginous,
so, yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So they're not going to preserve.
Not well, yeah. And that's the key thing. So, Hylodus has been known by its teeth for a long time.
Right.
And those Hylodus-style teeth go way back. We found bodies of Hylodus from Middle England, actually, the potteries where the Industrial Revolution kicked off in ironstone there.
Hmm.
Those ironstone nodules with Hylodus in, we CT scanned, and we were amazed that the cartilage is very flaky. It's very delicate, the cartilage. But with CT scans, it, you know, doesn't matter. We're not mechanically preparing it out. And the first thing we found on this was a tooth whorl, like you find in those buzzsaw sharks.
Helicopodes,
okay?
Right.
In Ray's Helicoprion.
And we found this tooth world.
Helicoprion.
Yeah.
Helicoprion.
And we found that, and we thought, oh, that's amazing. And then we didn't realize just how, you know, it's a sense of scale. Turns out this tooth world is tiny, and it's the end of a long plate going right down the snout, and it's hanging off the front of a tentaculum that is running from the forehead, what's possibly the ugliest fish in the fossil record.
I saw the CT scan when I was in your lab all those years ago, and absolutely just, like, I must draw this animal, and you've allowed me to do that. So my art will be in the paper, I guess.
So we're going to have a picture of this that you drew, Ray, on your webpage at paleonerds.com. Now, when I was looking up Helotus, I saw somewhere that it said Helotus is a wastebasket taxon. What does that mean? Or
the teeth are. There's a lot of teeth that have been labeled Helotus that now we can say those are not Helotus. But careful. What we find is that we have with our material the entire dentition of Helotus, and it's got a lot of different kinds of teeth in its jaws. And one of the things that struck us about it, before reconstructions attempted, it had given it a very modest dentition, these little cushion-shaped teeth. In fact, it's got these massive arrays of crushing teeth in its jaws that look a bit like those three-way bits that you get at the end of heavy-duty oil weld drilling. And they look like...
Really?
Yeah, they're really crunchy, knuckly things which sort of engage up and lower jaw.
Do they eat shellfish? What were those, their diet?
Probably anything they can get their jaws around. Anything.
What do ratfish eat now?
They're bottom feeders. With the Helotus, just to, so the audience understands this, is that that toothy bit, the tentaculum, was actually part of the upper jaw, which then begins in more modern forms. That's migrated all the way up into the middle of the head, and only the males have that, and those are basically teeth on the end of that tentaculum. They're like shark teeth there. It's coming out of the middle of the head, but only the males have them.
But it's a sexual clasper.
Well, it's not a clasper. Yes. It's basically a grappling hook to hold on.
Okay, right.
So that they can get their naughty bits together around their pelvic fins.
At the other
end. They don't really have prehensile tails or opposable.
Yeah, you got to hold on somewhere. Yeah. Need traction for the action.
And the weird thing is, as you say about the teeth, is that on the basis of the fossil material, and then this has been wonderfully corroborated, supported by the developmental biology, which Gareth Fraser's been doing,
right,
is that it's as if this tentaculum captured part of the old dentition from the front of the upper jaw, and it's preserved, it's kept it. The old tooth program, the old program for growing teeth, is still there on the tentaculum, while the rest of the dentition inside the mouth has become highly specialized. So the only place in a modern ratfish where you get some vestige of when it used to be able to grow teeth is on the tip of the tentaculum. It's bizarre.
The sexual.
Might.
Little archive.
Wow.
Is that like humans growing a tail in the next century because we need another grasping digit? Or is that retaining an ancient...
This is retaining.
It never got rid of it.
Yeah, but this is, it's retaining it. This is the ancient tooth-making gene that's there. Can we actually, looking at what Gareth is doing in his lab down in Florida, he's isolating that gene out of ratfish so that it's basically the tooth-producing thing, and I'm just leaping forward here. Will we someday be able to grow a tooth and we learned it from ratfish?
Well, first of all, he's looking at the expression of the normal set of genes that you find that are switched on in the little pockets of tissue where our teeth grow. And there are very characteristic sets of genes. And you look across all vertebrates and you'll find if they're growing teeth, you've got the usual customers turning up and doing their job there. So you've got a signature set of teeth.
Okay.
If you like, a combinatorial code of certain genes that switched on for a certain time to produce the dentine and produce the stuff that goes into the pulp cavity, the shaping genes and things like that.
The enamel.
So they're busy there. And these things don't have enamel because they're ratfish. But you've got the signature there. So that was the check to see, are those genes active in the tissues, if you like, the gum that produces the teeth at the tip of the tenaculum. That's what we suspected. That's what Gareth and his lab have demonstrated.
And it's very neat. Only the males have these teeth. So yeah. The females have the same gene. What's happened? They're born with that same gene?
They're just not switched on. They're just suppressed. Most of the time, most of our developmental toolkit, we want switched off. I mean, you had a lot of genes busy in you, Ray, when you were a baby and growing, or when you were a fetus. You don't want those switched on now. We've got a whole system which is basically suppressing genes and making sure that they're only expressed at the right time in the right place so that you are not growing teeth out of your forehead. But I'm quite sure this could be arranged.
I want to get back to the lamprey discovery, that they were originally thought to be the evolutionary beginnings of, or related to our
first jawless fishes.
Yeah, but they are not.
Again, you know, it's a bit like the story with sharks. People have looked at lampreys. And because where else are we going to look in the living biota to understand what a jawless fish is like, how they're going to grow? And that's our best model for it's some clue there about ancestral conditions. But lampreys, you know, this is the research program that I'm involved with. How do we make sense of the living biota? How do we understand living diversity? What parts are specialized and what parts are primitive? That is absolutely the nubbin of the research program. Mm-hmm. Sounds a bit dry, but that gives you the exciting opportunity to go and play with lampreys and work out, you know, the front end of a lamprey, it's pretty sophisticated. With all that oral hood, the wonderful circular array of toothlets, not teeth, these are made out of the same stuff as your fingernail there.
Keratin?
Yeah, and they don't grow like our teeth, they grow like a stack of coffee cups. So they grow and they shed. But within that, you've got a little so-called, well, textbooks, it's a piston cartilage, but I don't know how many textbooks I've looked in, and it calls it a lingual cartilage. It's got something to do with our tongue. It's not anything to do with our tongue. It's a piston. It's got little sideways nippers at the front of it.
Really?
So you've got all of this specialized new face. It's grown in front of its eyes and nose, etc., which is on the top of the head. So all of that business, highly specialized. But again, it's not bony, so it's not going to preserve well in the fossil record. So this is why there are a few little tiddlers known from a classic fossil site just south of Chicago, which is one of the best fossil coal swamps known. That's Mason Creek, or if you're a local down there, Mazon Creek.
That's where they found
the Tully Monster.
Tully Monster, yes. And it's where they have found some of the earliest lampreys. But they're tiddlers, and they're preserved sideways on. With Rob Guess, who's a former PhD student I co-advised in South Africa, Rob is fantastic field worker, etc., and has been studying Devonian fishes. So we go back to the Devonian now. And at the end of the Devonian, almost globally, you find this black shale, which gives us a clue about what's happening at the end of the Devonian, which is bad news for vertebrates. But in that black shale, in a place called the Waterloo Farm Formation, he was sitting there, and it's a classic instance of the road company come in to stabilize the
hillside, yeah.
Yeah. They take all this black shale out. Rob begs them to save it. So he gets it put under a big awning on his small holding he's got. So he spent his time just cleaving through this stuff, looking for bits. And he found this Devonian lamprey, and it's preserved face on. So
you got the mouth bits.
And it looks just like a modern lamprey. Not identical, but far more like a modern
380 million year old.
Yeah, 360 plus. So it's a late Devonian. And what's interesting, the end Devonian is this big extinction event. And I wouldn't have guessed that, if you like, things that look like modern lampreys were knocking around in the Devonian. So that takes lampreys as we know them now, and we recognize that those are nothing like Astraspis and Arundaspis and those armored-like tadpoles.
The first jawless fishes.
But now we've got something like a modern jawless vertebrate knocking around in that golden age of fishes again.